We are looking at the transition material, moving us closer and closer to the stories we find in the gospel. And we've been spending a lot of time talking about King Herod, who is earning now his nickname, the Great, because he is building things right and left. The last thing that we were talking about was how he was building all sorts of sports and drama and musical venues around Jerusalem in honor of Augustus Caesar for a great big celebration full of contests that would happen in the year 22 BC. That would be the fifth anniversary of Augustus becoming the new, for all practical purposes, emperor of this transitioning republic into empire. And that sort of building was just the start of what he was doing in order to gain this nickname, the Great. Now, one of the things that I think he figured out as the games went off in Jerusalem in 22 BC was that it wasn't as easy to come to Judea by sea as it should have been, because there weren't good port structures along the Mediterranean coast. And so right around the end of the 20s BC, he decided to start building the best protected harbor, man-made harbor, in the eastern Mediterranean. In fact, Josephus will say it will rival the man-made port that was servicing the city of Athens, and that was a very famous port. So the name of this city where that port is going to be located is going to be Caesarea, or Caesarea, in honor of Herod's friend and emperor, Augustus Caesar. And so we'll talk more about Caesarea at different times as we continue this story. So in the late 20s BC, so right around the time that Caesarea is starting to be built, right around the time the Augustus Games take place at Jerusalem, Herod decides that he's going to send his two young sons by the late Princess Mariamne. These sons' names are Alexander and Aristobulus. They're probably in their early teens. He's going to send them to Rome for education. That is not at all surprising, because he's developed a very close relationship with Augustus, and he wants his family to be tied in with this powerful person that is on the throne in Rome. And so while they are growing up and being educated at Rome, they're actually going to live in the royal palace with Augustus. Augustus is going to be like their adopted dad, or maybe like a family uncle, something of that nature. That's how he will be regarded by them. And that will also come up in our story later, how he feels about these two young men. In 20 BC, Augustus decides to tour the empire, and he's going to visit the Middle East. In that year, he was 43 years of age, which means that Herod is 53 years of age. And when Augustus visits the Middle East, he gives Herod control of even more territories than Herod already has. He gives him territories that are located east and northeast of the Sea of Galilee. And for all practical purposes, by this time, Herod has become the third most influential man in the Roman Empire. And I am not just stating that as my opinion, that's the opinion of Josephus. Antiquities, book number 15, verse number 10. Chapter number 10. Speaking of Augustus and his visit to the Middle East. He also made him one of the procurators of Syria and commanded that there should do everything with his approbation. And in short, he arrived at that pitch of felicity that whereas there were but two men that governed the vast Roman Empire, first Caesar and then Agrippa, who was his principal favorite, Caesar preferred no one to Herod besides Agrippa. And Agrippa made no one his greater friend than Herod besides Caesar. Now, this Agrippa here is going to cause us a little bit of a problem in our minds, because when we think of Agrippa, we think of Herod Agrippa the first and Herod Agrippa the second. That guy is actually named after this guy. There was a Roman leader that had assisted Caesar in his earlier life. And the two of them together became a powerful partnership in leading the Roman Republic. For all practical purposes, Agrippa was a co-emperor, or should we say a vice-emperor, with Augustus. So what happens here is that these two men develop a very close relationship with Herod, because Herod is just, he is so gung-ho on this idea of the Roman Republic, Roman Empire being led by Augustus, and he's building things right and left in the name of Augustus. He's also naming a few things in honor of Agrippa. And so he is rewarded by being given power in Syria. He becomes one of at least a pair, perhaps a trio, of Romans that are governing everything in Mesopotamia south to Egypt. And so more than likely, when they say here they're going to make him one of the procurators of Syria, they're basically affirming he's already in control of that land bridge between Mesopotamia and Egypt. And so he should also project his authority north and south from there. And as Josephus says, the other procurators in the region had to make sure that Herod was okay with whatever it is they wanted to do. And so that's how Herod becomes the third most influential person in the Roman Empire. Continuing here, it says, "And when he had acquired such freedom, he begged of Caesar a tetrarchy for his brother Pheroras." So this is his younger brother. "While he did himself bestow upon him a revenue of 100 talents out of his own kingdom." Now, each talent is equivalent to about a 6,000 days' wages for a common worker. So 100 talents is a huge amount of money, millions of dollars. And so Herod gives that money to his brother, and then that gets him started in a tetrarchy that was awarded to him by Caesar Augustus. And then continuing, "that in case he came to any harm himself, his brother might be in safety, and that his sons might not have dominion over him." And so he makes sure his brother's set up so that if something, you know, falls apart for himself, at least his brother will be okay. Continuing, "so when he had conducted Caesar to the sea and had returned home," that is, sent Caesar on his way back to Rome, he comes back to his kingdom of Judea, and it's actually Judea, Samaria, Galilee, Idumea, and then also what is now known as the Golan. So all of that is under Herod's control. So when he came back home, he built for Caesar, a most beautiful temple. Now, when it says temple here, it is a shrine building in honor of Augustus, because Augustus is not dead. He is still a living person. And so he built him this beautiful temple of the whitest stone of Zenodorus' country near the place called Paneum. Now, I'm going to break in and talk about this because I've been here several times now. Those of you that might want to go with me on a trip to Israel in October of 2023, you will go to this very place, Paneum. It's called Benaeus or Paneus. It's known in the New Testament as Caesarea Philippi. And when the Greeks first came with Alexander the Great, and then after him kind of established kingdoms in the region, they saw this location as something special because it's the headwaters, one of the headwaters for the Jordan River. And the water comes out of a cave, out of a grotto, and flows into the river southward. And this grotto, this cave, is in the side of this massive cliff that is actually part of the foothills of Mount Hermon, which is the highest mountain in this part of the world. And when the Greeks saw this water flowing out of this cave in a remote place with lots and lots of trees around, they decided that this was a place to worship Pan, the god of the wilderness. And so that's how it got its name, Paneum, or Paneus. When the kingdom of the Jews got started with the Hasmoneans, this place continued to be occupied by a lot of Greeks. And they started putting some of their idols, some of their worship items nearby this grotto, this cave. And so it has become a sacred site, if you will, for many of the people of this region. So Herod has decided that his friend, the emperor, who is a great and august person, hence the name Augustus, should have his own special site at Paneum. And so he builds him a white stone shrine right in front of that cave. Now, you might remember I said that water at this time had been running out of this cave and forming the headwaters of the Jordan. So what happens is they made piping underneath the floor of this new white shrine building. And guess what, folks? I did not see how they did this until my most recent visit there. When I was there in March of this past year, of this year, 2022, they have now excavated the piping. So we know exactly how they did it because they are working right now. It is an active archaeological site trying to identify the boundaries and the arrangement of this Augustus shrine building. And so I actually took a few not so great pictures of the newly excavated piping underneath this shrine building. So I'm very excited about that. And I'm looking forward to see what else they've done by the next time I get there in October of next year. All right, so here is the rest of his description, which is spot on. It says, "This is a very fine cave in a mountain, under which there is a great cavity in the earth, and the cavern is abrupt and prodigiously deep and full of still water. Over it hangs a vast mountain, and under the caverns arise the springs of the river Jordan. Herod adorned this place, which was already a very remarkable one, still further by the erection of this temple, which he dedicated to Caesar." Now, At some point after the New Testament era, there was an earthquake and part of the ceiling of that grotto cave collapsed in to the pool and stopped up the active water flowing out of the grotto into the headwaters of the Jordan. And so that's what you see now, is kind of just rainwater gathers in the bottom of that collapsed grotto. But the spring water that's under the surface is now oozing out just underneath the south end of the excavated area for the temple building of Augustus. And so you can see all that very clearly. And I hope some of you will go with me so you can see it with your own eyes. Now, that's everything that he was doing in 20 BC when Augustus came for a visit. And I've told you that Herod desperately wants to get along with the Jewish people, particularly the religious Jewish people. And so despite being the third most powerful person in the empire, he still feels insecure in his relationship with the people that he's directly ruling, the Jews. And so in that same year, 20 BC, he decided to cut taxes by a third. So a 33% reduction in taxes. That certainly should get the people to like you better, right? He also made sure that there were a lot of construction projects going on to keep everyone employed. So keeping high employment, having make work projects, that also keeps people happy. And by the way, there were plenty of projects go around because he is trying to bring his kingdom up to the status as the showplace of the empire. So they are putting in Roman roads all over his kingdom. They are putting in aqueducts, water supply aqueducts all over his kingdom so that there's fresh water everywhere. He's putting in ancient sewage arrangements and things of that nature. He is building cities up from their maybe slightly ruined status to a much more modern arrangement. He's doing this all over his kingdom. So there's plenty of construction work going on in the year 20 BC. And it makes people happy to have all that employment. But then he did some things that would make all of us very uncomfortable. He required citizens to take an oath of loyalty to him personally. None of us like that idea. But he exempted those whose faith forbid such oaths. So he's making sure that the exceptionally religious Jewish groups won't be offended by his asking of loyalty. And so his spies kept him apprised of public opinion regarding himself and his actions. So he's constantly got guys out there checking the ideas and the mindset of the people. And then he does something that all of us have heard in other stories of the ancient world. He made a habit of going around on his own incognito. So he'd take off his royal robes and disguise himself and go out and talk to people to try to learn what people were thinking about King Herod. And that would have been interesting to be involved in some of those exchanges, wouldn't it? So this desire to be liked, perhaps even loved by the Jewish people, the religious Jewish people, was the impetus for his next, and I believe his most amazing project. And that was the complete renovation of the Jewish temple. And all that begins in 20 BC. By that time, he had been king of the Jews at Jerusalem for 18 years. He was, as I said, 53 years of age. And he had already renovated much of Jerusalem. And was in the process of renovating much of the country. He was putting in a brand new man-made massive harbor at Caesarea on the coast. But he had a temple building that was approaching 400 and almost 500 years, 480 some years of age. This is the temple building that had been built by Zerubbabel when he came back from the Babylonian exile. And so Herod gets it in his mind, this temple needs to match everything else that I'm doing. It needs to be as grand and glorious as I'm trying to make everything else in my kingdom. And so he goes to the Jewish people with a proposal. And Josephus writes about that proposal in Antiquities of the Jews, book 15, chapter number 11. Quote, "I think I need not speak to you, my countrymen, about such other works as I have done since I came to the kingdom, although I may say that they have been performed in such a manner as to bring more security to you than glory to myself. For I have neither been negligent in the most difficult times about what tended to ease your necessities, nor have the buildings I have made been so proper to preserve me as yourselves from injuries. And I imagine that, with God's assistance, I have advanced the nation of the Jews to a degree of happiness which they never had before, and for the particular edifices belonging to your own country and to your own cities, as also to these cities that we have lately acquired, which we've erected and greatly adorned, and thereby augmented the dignity of your nation, it seems to me a needless task to enumerate them to you, since you well know them yourselves. But as to that undertaking which I have in mind to set about at present, and which will be a work of the greatest piety and excellence that can possibly be undertaken by us, I will now declare to you." Now, let me persuade you to not believe some bad teaching of the past, some bad implications of movies and books. And that is the impression that Jerusalem and Judea and Galilee and the places of the Jews were somehow the backwater of the Roman Empire, that they were filthy, dirty, and broken down, and not a place you'd really like to live, and the people were horribly impoverished. That is not the case. Here is testimony of Herod the Great, after he's kind of earned that title, that he has brought his kingdom up to the highest standard in the Roman Republic, an awful lot of it by his building of all sorts of public works, including roads and bridges and water and sewer and security programs and things of that nature. And so you need to picture Jerusalem and Judea and all these lands as being kind of the best places to live in the Roman Republic of this time. And Herod's bragging on that to the people. And then he drops the big bombshell on them. Here it comes. "Our fathers indeed, when they returned from Babylon, built this temple to God Almighty. Yet does it want 60 cubits of its largeness in altitude." Now, 60 cubits, that's 90 feet. That's the missing tower that was on Solomon's temple that was not built on Zerubbabel's temple. And so that's a major feature of the renovation that he wants to do. And we'll talk more about that. "For so much did that first temple which Solomon built exceed this temple. Nor let anyone condemn our fathers for their negligence or want of piety herein. For it was not their fault that the temple was no higher, for there was Cyrus and Darius, the son of Hystapases, who determine the measurings for its rebuilding. And so Herod says, look, guys, this temple is nothing like the Solomon Temple. But that's not our forefathers' fault. Because when they came back from Babylon under Cyrus and then under Darius, they had to follow the rules laid out by those leaders as to how big this temple could be. Now, when we come back next week, this is where we're going to pick up. And Herod is effectively going to say, look, guys, we don't have to live by that poor standard now. We have control of the situation. Let's build big.